Well, or I should say writes, because the thing exists in draft for a long time before it's published. When he finally figures out the Copernican system, he does not have in it, oh, maybe 1 or 2% of the observations that are involved in constructing it are other than ones available to Ptolemy and ones Ptolemy uses. The Copernican system doesn't involve any significant new observations. In fact, so much so that Kepler had the benefit of Tycho's. Tycho is the first person to make observations worth paying attention to since antiquity. Kepler has the benefit of those. These are made in the 1560s, 70s, 80s, 90s after Copernicus is dead. Kepler, who has the benefit of these better observations, does make this remark about Copernicus, that Copernicus is pretty good, the only problem is he interpreted Ptolemy, not nature. Because he takes all the Ptolemaic stuff and then just transforms it into Copernican stuff. And in fact, if you put his book, which I am now about to pass around, this is a reprint of, in fact, Kepler's very own copy of Copernicus's De Revolutionibus. So all the little scribblings in it are Kepler's scribblings. There aren't too many of them. This napkin doesn't mean anything. Maybe it does. I'm not sure why I put it there. I'll pass this around. This is what the book looks like. In fact, this book is structured exactly like Ptolemy. Book one is about the same thing, book two is about the same thing, book three is about the same thing, book four is about the same thing, except it's the Copernican scheme, not the Ptolemaic. In book three, I think he takes the two planets that stay near the Sun, Mercury and Venus. In book four, he takes the three planets that don't stay near the Sun, Mars, Jupiter, Saturn. In book five, he does the Moon. I haven't got it right, but I mean, the same subjects in the same chapters. It's really rewritten Ptolemy. So it's very Ptolemaic, and in that sense, backward-looking and conservative. So why is Copernicus a Copernican? Well, there are lots of possibilities for that, and probably all of them enter into it to some extent. But perhaps the easiest way to see it is by saying, noticing, when Copernicus considers a possibility that everyone knows, and Ptolemy knows too, is one of these logical possibilities, conceptual possibilities, namely that it's the motion of the Earth, a daily motion, that's causing the daily rising and setting, causing that appearance. And the annual motion of the Earth is something that hasn't been discussed so much. You'll notice that when Moran and Corradine are talking about that, they're not talking about revolution around the Sun, they're just talking about spinning. But it has been thought, there is an ancient speculation about the Earth going around the Sun, but nobody does quite connect it to appearances. So that, in some ways, is sort of original with Copernicus. But when he begins to see what it might look like if the Earth is moving, and that it's because we're on a moving Earth that some of those things appear as they do, it's sort of like the penny drops. I mean, it's kind of like that duck-rabbit gestalt swoop sort of thing. It's not like he sees this stepwise, I don't think. It's kind of like all at once. He realizes that there's this peculiar coincidence in Ptolemy. And the peculiar coincidence is basically this. And this is in the real original Ptolemy. It's not a later corruption. It's important that we now know what the original good thing was, and we're not dealing with some screw-up in the 9th century. This is the best Ptolemy could do, because it's his own stuff. Whenever you set up to calculate where's a planet going to be, and that's what these professional astronomers have to do. All right, let's now make the table for Mars. So we set up the apparatus for Mars. Deferent circle, epicycles, we know what their rates are. Then we take a known date and a known position, and we plug it in, and then just turn the crank, and we crank out positions for all preceding and subsequent dates, right? Whenever you set up to do this for Mercury or Venus or Mars or Jupiter or Saturn, to set the system up right, to get things in place properly, you always need to know where the Sun is. So for example, for Venus or Mercury, the Sun always has to be on the line, centered on the line that connects the Earth with the center of the first major epicycle. If you don't set it up that way, you're going to get it all wrong. Everything's just going to be wrong. The reason why this is pretty apparent. Remember, Mercury and Venus never get more than a certain distance from the Sun, and they go equal on either side of it. So when you set it up, the Sun's got to be in the middle. Why? Well, what do you mean, why? That's the way it is, right? You know, you might as well say, why does it rise in the east, not in the north? Who the hell knows? That's the way it is. When you set up Mars, Jupiter, or Saturn, and it's interesting that it's different, these two go together and these three go together. When you set up Mars, Jupiter, and Saturn, the second epicycle, the line connecting the center of that epicycle and the planet, what they call the radius vector, this is really just the radius line to the planet, this has to be set up so that that line is parallel to the line between the Earth and the Sun. You just have to set it up that way or it ain't going to be right.
Where is this radius vector?
This
when you're looking at it, you determine?
No, you're setting up the problem. You've got a known position for Jupiter. And he's got to say, all right, where's Jupiter in my theory? Well, I see Jupiter here against those stars. Now I have to ask, where's the Sun? Maybe it's up here. It's probably down here. I got to get that line, then I can make my line to there. You see, in order to locate these guys properly with respect to each other.
So you don't locate them first, you locate them using the Sun.
Yeah, all you know is that whatever else is happening, this line and that line have to be parallel.
The long line is the Earth-Sun line?
The long line is the Earth-Sun line. This again is, now it's a little complicated because this is a line between the Earth and the mean Sun. I mean, these guys work with average Sun, the real Sun's wiggling around on either side of that, but that's just a technical detail. Why? Well, one way you know this has to be true is because everybody knows that when Jupiter is retrograding down there at the bottom of its little epicycle, the Sun is in opposition. Everybody knows that. But when Mars, Jupiter, and Saturn do that backwards junk, you know, they're slipping like this, they stop, they start doing this, and then they keep, well, they're slipping back again. Whenever they do this thing, the Sun is in opposition. And that's just the way things are. So if somebody says, well, why do I have to set it up this way? It's because that's the way things are. There's nothing else to say about it. Copernicus says, I mean, this is so typical of the different idea, the new way of looking at things. Copernicus says, this is a pretty amazing coincidence. Well, it's just a coincidence, Nick. I mean, what's the big deal? Well, how do you know it's a coincidence? Maybe it's not a coincidence. Or, do you see how funny these things are? But I want to explain it. Well, explain what? Explain this coincidence. But if it's a coincidence, there's nothing to explain. No, maybe there's a connection here. You know? Is it an accident or is it a coincidence? I mean, is it...
Yes.
Is it a coincidence? Is it a coincidence or does it signify something? Well, who knows? You know? I mean, it would get to the point where if you have some explanation for it and you like it, then of course it's not a coincidence. If you don't have an explanation for it and you can't imagine anyone that you'd ever buy, then of course it's a coincidence, right? Remember all those astrological connections we were noticing. The 9-month Venus cycle. Is that a coincidence? Well, of course it is. Is the menstrual cycle and the lunar cycle a coincidence? I don't know, ask Darwin. I mean, who knows? Is it or isn't it? Right? Maybe it's just a coincidence. But if you think about these things, you can't help but say, well, maybe it's not. But then you know, pretty soon you're getting close to these crazy people that measure the sides of the pyramid, divide them by pi, then multiply everything, and you get, I don't know, Brian Mulroney's birthday. Is that a coincidence? Of course it is, you lunatic. Right? Of course it's a coincidence. It means absolutely nothing. Well, how do you know? So, I mean, we're into this kind of funny terrain where somebody's singling out something and saying, look, this is no coincidence. But you can't help but think that one of the reasons he doesn't think it's a coincidence is because he's got a thing that will explain it. This business of you always got to know where the sun is when you want to find out where are Mars, Mercury, Venus, or Mars, Jupiter, or Saturn, this stops being a coincidence if you say the sun is in the middle, all this stuff's going around it, and the Earth is between Mercury and Venus and Mars, Jupiter, and Saturn. And all of a sudden, you know why. If Mercury and Venus are between us and the sun, going around the sun, now you know why they can't ever seem more than so far from the sun, and the sun's always going to be in the middle of what they're doing. And now you know why. If Mars, Jupiter, and Saturn are going around on the outside, why they're going to have that funny appearance of stopping, going back, speeding up again, because that's when we overtake them on an inside track. And there's the sun. The sun's there. It's got to be there when those, because that's when they, and they're not really retrograding. I mean, we could go out and do a dance and start walking around in circles around 10. The sun. We could do that, and you know, we could do this in pairs, and he could be Mars, and if you were Earth, he'd walk a little slower than you, and you'd overtake him on inside track, and you'd watch over the top of his head the trees, and he would look like he was going like this. As you did that, I mean, you know, go do it with somebody. Get your kids or your friends to. Yeah, I mean, it just happens. So there's the stars, which now are at rest. And you know, the only thing you can see is the stuff compared to the stars, so that's how it looks. So this is Copernicus's idea. Here's the sun, here's Mercury, here's Venus, here's the Earth, the moon's going around the Earth, and so on, and blah, blah, blah. On the last page of your Galileo excerpts, you have Galileo's own drawing connecting up various Earth positions with various Jupiter positions. And you can see how the appearance of Jupiter 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12, 13, 14. Anyway, so basically this is it. I mean, this is, whoa, all right, this is it. There's one more thing to say, but I can...
I'm maybe coming to that. I just wondered if he had that conceptualized why did he still need to be paid at the site?
Oh, well, you'll see. You'll see.
It seems like you wouldn't need them.
You do.
Yeah.
You do. Because he's good, because...
Well,
cause
circles
these are all
the
circles.
Ellipses, like that.
The ellipses, what the hell, no.
Yeah.
These are circles.
Right.
And since they're circles, and you
work.
Are observing variations in speed,
yeah,
you've got to do something.
Yeah.
It's the speed variation.
That's the one that kills. The ellipses aren't so bad because they're nearly circular anyway.
Oh, I know.
Yeah.
But these guys are fine-tuned enough that if it's a circle and it's uniform motion, you're way out.
Yeah.
So you've got to put in some more circles. You got it? Well, at least say yes, right? Now, other things kind of come tumbling out, but I'm not sure this is the sequence. I mean, this might be happening backwards from how I'm telling it to you, but this is sort of all happening finally at once. The other thing, of course, is that in Ptolemy, as Copernicus says, it really isn't a system. You want to know where the planets are? All right, you take them one at a time. You do Mars, you do Jupiter, you do Venus, you do Mercury. There they are. Well, but what's the order of the planets as we go out from the Earth? Well, all that astronomy has got to say, and this is the best of Earth-centered Ptolemaic astronomy, is, well, it would make most sense that the faster it is, the nearer it is. So the moon is real fast, goes around in a month through the stars, so that's probably the nearest. And the next most fast is Mercury, so it's probably the next nearest. And so that's it. Well, but how far? And all the, who knows? In other words, there's no built-in kind of ordering. If you say slower, farther, then fine. Why should that be? Well, makes sense, but it's not a system. You've just got one planet after another. And yes, they do change speeds. There's no reason why they should. They just do. And so Copernicus says, you see, what I've got is a system. This all hangs together. It has to be that the Earth is here. And that guy is there, Venus. And this one is there, Mercury. And this one's there, and that one's there, and that one's there. They have to be in this order, or else what we see wouldn't be happening like it does. What's more, and I can't lay out the diagram for this because I can never remember it. I'll make a note to myself to write this down on paper and give it to you. Because Copernicus has now got us observers on a moving Earth, he's now got a moving platform, and he can essentially do surveying. And he can calculate, and I'll show you how on a piece of paper, I won't explain it now. But by making pairs of observations of the Sun and the planet, what's with the Earth here? By making pairs of observations of the planet and the sun at the same time, two sets of observations, he's able to set up, he's basically able to set up a geometric situation in which he can compute the ratio of this line to that line, the ratio of the planet-sun distance and the Earth-sun distance. These are absolute ratio. Because he's on a moving Earth, he can now do surveying. He basically can do triangulation. And you make the observation so that you can get some right angles in here and make life easy. And now, so he can compute, he can tell you not only what the order has to be, but he can tell you absolutely planet-sun distances in terms of Earth-sun distance. Now call this 1, so that's 0.8 or something. Call this 1, so that's 1.6 or something. Whatever it is. This can't be done in Ptolemy. There's just no way. it might be that this is why Copernicus is a Copernican. Because if you do these computations, which in some inverted way you could imagine doing from a stationary Earth, they don't mean anything. If you imagine it's the Earth that's moving, they do mean something. And it may be that Copernicus thinks they ought to mean something. So I must be on a moving platform. That's a kind of inverted way of putting it. But anyway, there we are. So I've got a system, damn it. This thing hangs together. What we got with Ptolemy is, remember this passage, we have a monster. It's as if a sculptor took a head from here, an arm from there, a torso from here, a nose from there, and stuck it all together and said, hey, look, this would be a monster. It would be monstrous. It wouldn't be harmonious. This is all the same. This is a harmonious whole. And the parts relate to the whole, and it's wonderful, and I love it. And it's great.
So Copernicus reduces the number of choreographers.
Well, there is this kind of business of there's less epicycles and all this stuff. In one sense, that's true.
See, they're not doing their own, they're all doing their own thing altogether.
Oh.
And see, sort of being themselves in some sort of great master.
Well, so that, yes, like this is a real ballet now, not a do-it-yourself spin around.
Yeah, right. Right.
That's true. No, I don't, he doesn't talk that way. But let's talk about this counting epicycle stuff. I mean, the issue, in a sense, is this simpler than Ptolemy? Well, in one sense, it is if your taste is inclined to the kind of argument he's making. I've got something that hangs together here. And isn't this better than this ad hoc business of one at a time and coincidences and arbitrary stuff and whatnot? Now, of course, if you ask Copernicus, how come all this junk is going on east to west and within the zodiac and why are things rising and resetting? He doesn't know. He doesn't have the foggiest idea. Well, come on, is it just a coincidence?
I don't know. But he hasn't conceived of everything being in the same plane, or has.
Well, I think if you said to him, isn't all this stuff going on pretty much in the same area, he'd say, yeah. But planes, no. The only reason Kepler can get an ellipse out of the data is because he insists that ellipse is in a plane which cuts through the sun. If he doesn't insist that, he's lost. Copernicus isn't even thinking those thoughts. He's not thinking about planes or any such thing. He's just doing that latitude, longitude.
He can conceive at all of the planets being visible by.
Oh, yeah.
They do think of them as being something somewhat like the Earth.
So no.
No. But I mean.
Three-dimensional?
Yeah, I'm thinking, when I say physical body, I mean, well, I don't know, something you can stand on.
They're not, until Copernicus, it's not, it's pretty clear they're. It's pretty clear they're different than Earth stuff. Are they three-dimensional bodies? Sure. The moon's round. It's a sphere. Well, I think this is, you know, this would make you look backwards from here if you were to work on it. A very nice paper, which I certainly get a lot out of reading, is if somebody took the trouble, which I have never done, to find out what do medieval or ancient philosophers say about how you get planets. I mean, here's the celestial realm, eh? It's all fifth element. Well, what's the difference between where you see nothing and where you see planets? Some people say they're real quintessential fifth element spheres. Well, what's the difference between all that sphere where you see nothing and where you see a planet? The usual answer, I think, is density. There's more of that stuff where the planet is, so it's more compact fifth element stuff. And that's what makes it visible. But there's also this problem about the sun. And here's the sun giving off all this blessed light. Isn't it really like a big fire? Well, that's terrestrial stuff. How can it be hot? Well, that's an ancient kind of myth. But, you know, good philosophy, high culture says the sun's up there in the realm of the unchanging, so it can't be fire. Well, how does the sun heat? Well, you get all this stuff about informing and forms, and it's pure, and you put down here all this stuff happening. But it's pretty unclear to me how this all hangs together so that a mind is satisfied with it. But usually the idea is density. Jupiter may well be a hunk of one of the spheres of Jupiter. These epicycles are really roller bearings. I mean, some people try to mechanize this. Other people say, no, it's like a bird in the air. There's no machinery at all. Whatever it is, it's a more dense piece of sky stuff.
But it's physical stuff.
Well, yeah, but it's a little weird still. I mean, you see, again, it's got to do with a matter of emphasis. Somebody could say, look, the moon's all grotty. What do you mean incorruptible? It's grotty. Look at it. You know, it looks like the Delta dump up there. You know, if we could get closer, we'd see seagulls every day. Right? And what's more, it reflects light. It reflects light. That's sunlight bouncing off it. But it's not like this stuff has a reflecting light. What's going on here? Well, who knows? I mean, but you see, when you've got everything else going, that becomes a kind of research problem. How, all right, get to, here, you, PhD thesis. How does the moon reflect light, since given that it's fifth element stuff? Well, get to work on it. You know, if you're real good, we'll make you canon of Freiburg or something, right? That's incentive, so get to work on it. You want to be a good son? This is what you do. 1 minute? 30 seconds? Okay. All right. Okay. Anyway, so let's say one thing about this business of simply. In one sense, it's simply. Why? Because it hangs together for people that are tuned into that fact. It's a fact that hangs together. It's a fact that it explains quite naturally what is a coincidence in tolerance. Good. Terrific. That's progress. It deals with something. Gives an account of it. Are there less epicycles? Well, in one sense, yes, because what used to be the major epicycle for each of the planets is now the orbit of the Earth. Okay, so you can take that one away. But you still need the other ones, because seen from the Earth or from anywhere else, there's this variation in speed and latitude and longitude for all the planets. Got to cover that. Further, yeah.
At least it says 80 for tall.
Yeah, well, this is all
34.
This is all.
I couldn't figure that out whether it was not accurate. Okay, 80 for 34.
Yeah, well, notice if you want to go to an eccentric circle, you can lose an epicycle. If you want to have a centered circle, they have to add an epicycle. So whether they come or go is, in a way, trivial.
Yeah.
Simpler. Well, watch this. Another thing, this whole system is hooked up to the center of the Earth's circle. The Earth is going around in a perfect circle at uniform speed around the center. Book one, in the popular version of Copernicus, what's at the center of it all? The Sun, right? But if you say, if you really put the Sun there and have the Earth go around in a perfect circle, you've got a lousy solar field. You're never going to be right about where the Sun is. The Sun's better be somewhere else. Well, what's the first option? Put the Sun on the circle around the center of the Earth's circle. Not good enough. You have to put the Sun on an epicycle going around the center. It's going around the center. Well, what's the difference between this and having the Sun going around on a deck when you put up the Sun? This is important. From the point of view of computation, how many computations do I have to make? It's identical. And indeed, from the point of view of the technical astronomer, they've got to be identical. Just think of it. Same data, uniform circular motion. Well, to get from the theory to the data, you've got to go through the same steps either way.
might be less epicycles because one of them is replaced always by the motion of the Earth, but you've got to compute that in anyway. So whether you call it an epicycle or the Earth's orbit, it's the same job. So from the point of view of computation, although in some way it might be, now we can use a very simpler is hanging together stuff. Oh, right. And sorry, and the thing that's a big deal for the current. Now, in the midst of all that wonderful
buoy. I don't dictate those words. The buoy was about all those wonderful things I said about Harriet and looking at the moon and Sam Edgerton and all that stuff. Okay. All right. Well, we left ourselves off last time with Copernicus does look like he's got, in some ways, a simpler astronomy. He's got a system, and he can argue it's a system as opposed to Ptolemy's stack of planet theories. And he can offer a natural explanation, if you will, of things that seem to be coincidences in Ptolemy. But there's one kind of horrendous problem that keeps it all from being very simple. And that is, however harmonious all this is, or however systematic or natural, whatever nice things it does that Ptolemy doesn't explain, it does do one thing. And this I suppose, when you read Kuhn about scientific revolutions, you'll see that this might be pretty typical. When you get a new contradictory theory like this, I mean, here's the situation, and we could generalize from it and not be far wrong. When we get, let's just stick to the astronomy for a minute. When we get Ptolemy and Copernicus, as I said last time, we have a situation of two astronomers, 2,000 years apart, 1,500 years apart, sharing virtually the same data and sharing virtually the same methods of computation, namely uniform circular motion. And we said counting epicycles doesn't really get at it, because you can have less epicycles if you have eccentric circle. If you take the deference and make them eccentric, then you can get rid of an epicycle. But you still have the two computations for eccentricity and for the deference. So counting circles doesn't help too much. You have the same observations, the same theoretical commitment to uniform circular motion, and so the same to get from one to the other is going to involve pretty much the same work. So what we have, though, if we're realists about theories, and this becomes an issue, of course, if we want to interpret theories as saying something about the world, if they say something about the world, then we have a situation here of two theories which could be said, this is the arguing point, could be said to be equally adequate to the evidence. That is, they essentially share the same data. They both make the same predictions. The only reason Copernicus, well, how should I put it? One thing that's interesting and I guess monumental about all this, Copernicus is the first astronomer in the history of astronomy to propose a moving Earth astronomy that is as good as reliable a predictor of positions as any Earth-centered, Earth-resting astronomy. And that's, in one sense, what's monumental here. Copernicus has actually got a technical astronomy that's as good as Ptolemy's, as reliable, can make calendars with it. That has not happened before. You can speculate all you want about a spinning Earth, but if you can't deliver the goods, then you may not have anything. But notice, as we said, what he has to do to be able to deliver the goods, he has to get himself involved in epicycles just as thoroughly as Ptolemy does. So what we have is a situation, and maybe this is the classic case, two theories, equally reliable, sharing, in a sense, the same data, so sitting on the same observations, or having as consequences the same set of observations, and they are incompatible. That is, one's true, the other's got to be false. They can't both be true if you interpret the theoretical claims realistically. And maybe even if you don't, I'd get a little lost here. But certainly the claims in the hypothesis are contradictory. One of them has a moving Earth and the other doesn't. So what do you do? How do you choose between them?
There's no significance attached to the improvement with regard to the moon, but no one really worries about that too much.
Well, maybe it went by you. That improvement with respect to the moon is also equally... Notice on the moon, both of them agree the moon goes around the Earth. So he basically takes the best Ptolemaic theory of the moon, which is this Arabic two-seat couple innovation with the crane. But so he basically takes a good 10th century lunar theory and plugs it into his lunar theory. So that'll go either way. So what do you do? Well, you start talking about simplicity. Well, what is that? Or why should nature be simple? Or just because it pleases you, how do you know that's the way things are? But notice you can't, although it seems kind of fuzzy, there is this sense in which Copernicus seems simpler, just because of the business about being able to compute absolute ratios of planet-sun distances. But, as I said, all that seems to be overwhelmed by the problem, if you are a realist about theories, of moving the Earth. It's not simple to propose as the best explanation of things that the Earth is spinning and hurtling around the Sun. Everybody knows that physics proclaims that to be false and impossible. So, it's not simple. And I asked you to, for tonight, see if you could find out in reading the introductory stuff in Copernicus, and as I said, I think it's in section 7 and 9. Copernicus does try in book 1, nowhere else in De Rev, to make a kind of plausibility argument, or try to make a case for the physical, to make physical sense of a moving Earth. He certainly has made astronomical sense of a moving Earth. No problem there. That's done. But he does, he's aware he's got to try to make physical sense of a moving Earth. So, did anyone discover his, how he does it? What does he say? What does he say? What does he say in order to at least begin to make a case? I understand. I mean, it seems pretty plain. He doesn't think he's nailed it down. He's got rhetorical questions and so on. But he is trying to make a physical case for a moving Earth. And what does he say? Anybody remember? Anybody find it? No? Come on, you guys. This is not a kindergarten. What do you think?
Well, one of his things that he said, if you think that moving Earth is funny, what do you think the speed of those moving stars is going to be?
Okay, yes, there is that remark about those of you that find the motion of the Earth objectionable, think about how far away the stars are, and they're farther away than Saturn. Think how fast they have to be going. Now, what's the problem with that? I mean, yes, it's something he can say, but in a sense, he, for that argument to be interesting, he has to assume what he's trying to prove, I think. Do you see how?
You have to assume that the stars are material objects. Hmm.
If the stars aren't made out of this kind of stuff, but are made out of that kind of stuff, then so what? How fast they go? What's that got to do with anything? They're not going to fly apart. They're not made out of this kind of heavy stuff. Right? So maybe they're just humming out there. So what? They're the kind of stuff that whirls real fast. In fact, they're going so fast, from one point of view, they're almost resting. Right? They're kind of blurred. So, for that to be a real problem, he's playing on the idea that the stars might be like this. In which case, yes, that's horrendously fast, and what in the world's going on? Yeah.
He said something about the fact that if they're moving, there's no way they can shift around without affecting the universe as a whole.
That's got to do with his ratios of distances. Yeah. That's his way of telling you, hey, look, this hangs together. If we shift any one of them, all the others have to shift in response, because we have observationally, we can measure absolute ratios of planet-sun distances in terms of the Earth-sun distance. And what he means is we've got those numbers. Now, it's ratios, so it's not absolute distances, it's absolute ratios. But what he means is we've got, how should we put it, we've got the proportions. Absolute sizes is another problem.